Alrighty, welcome back, Iowa. You're listening to Around the House. My name is Tim Hetty, and I usually have my co-host Rod Fox here, but he had to leave the state and go to Pennsylvania for some reason, visit family or, I don't know, something like that. So, back by popular demand, I have Jesse Patton. He's with Associations Marketing Group, and he is what I consider to be an expert on the new healthcare stuff. And even though last week I said don't bother sending me any questions because I really don't want to cover this topic again, got a lot of feedback, so I asked Jesse to come back on, and he was gracious enough to be my co-host today. So, Jesse, good morning, and how's it going?
Well, good morning, and thanks for having me back again.
You bet. And I want you to know it's actually highly unusual for us not to talk about home repair and improvement on this show. And as I said last week, really didn't want to have a lot of feedback because the last thing I want to do is have some kind of political show because I don't follow enough of it to really be informed. And that's really one of the reasons why I wanted you to come on this show to begin with, because I think with this healthcare thing, while I do agree that maybe our healthcare system in the United States needs an overhaul, I think we're kind of taking the wrong path here. And I don't think most people understand exactly what this means to them and the impact financially and the quality of your health care and the speed at which you get your health care. I think everybody thinks that, hey, we get beyond this and everything's just going to be great. Like, you know, being in Canada, we're going to have this great socialist health care system. And I know a number of Canadians, and they'll be the first ones to tell you not to do it. That's my own opinion, but anyways, so I appreciate you coming back, and so I have several talking points, but I know you have some too, so why don't I just let you dive right into
well,
it.
Well, again, thanks for having me again. You know, the 2,700 pages, and it's a lot of legislation, so 40 minutes is not much time to talk about.
And you've read all 2,700 pages, from what I understand.
And again, like I said last week, that's not a good claim of fame. It shows you how dull of a life I've got reading healthcare legislation on a regular basis. But, you know, everybody has to understand that, you know, healthcare impacts them and their family. You know, we're talking about 1/6 of the economy. And we also have to understand that, you know, I've had the fortune to spend some time with the former Prime Minister of Canada, Prime Minister Chrétien. Their form of government is a parliament. Ours is a democracy. Works a little bit different. And so all those things factor in when you start looking at, you know, the healthcare and how it's regulated and how laws are passed. One thing I did want to touch on, last week we did talk about the employer penalty under the healthcare bill, which applies to employers that have more than 50 full-time equivalent employees. And then, as we discussed last week, you get a come back to your full-time employees and then look at the fact that you get to eliminate the first 30 full-time employees. And if you didn't offer an essential benefit plan or a health insurance plan, you're looking at a $2,000 penalty per employee. There were actually three penalties in the health care bill on employers over 50 full-time equivalent. At this point in time, we've eliminated what we called the voucher penalty, and I won't even get into that, but there was a third penalty that we've eliminated since the passage of health care reform.
Before you go any further, and I want you to come back to this point, but let's think about even the premise of this. When we talk about penalizing our employers, our job creators, we're going to penalize our job creators. That's essentially what this boils down to. These guys have done nothing wrong outside of try to be good business people and, you know, employ people, and yet we're talking about penalizing them. So go on. I just wanted to stop you there and talk about that particular point, because it doesn't seem right to me. You know, most employers, I know one guy, for instance, he's got 150 employees. He's out on Long Island in New York. 150 employees, and he's in the service industry, and he told me personally, he says, more than likely I'm going out of business. Now, what has this guy done wrong? Outside of hiring 150 employees, what's he done wrong? Since he's in the service industry, and basically, we're talking about like bug guys, okay? You know, guys that come and spray the pesticides.
Correct.
So to visit your home might be $30. Where's this money? This money's not in there. So who's going to allow that guy to double his fee because now all of a sudden he's being penalized for being a good businessman and accumulating 150 employees. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's okay. You know, like I say, what the Congress and the administration decided to do with this piece of legislation is, you know, continue down the path of the employer-based system that the government, you know, decided to really work in the 1940s, and that's where we've continued. As I said last week, I think we've missed an opportunity in our employer groups over 50, over 90% of them provide coverage today. It's really in the small employer market under 50 that we've got an issue with uninsureds and a shortage of coverage being provided. And we really, in my view, instead of penalizing the employer over 50, we needed to take some of this money that we spent in this health care bill and applied it towards subsidies. Better subsidies for our smaller employer that they could actually provide coverage for their people. We could have really made a bigger dent in the uninsured population, but we didn't do that. But the other point I was going to get to was there is a second penalty toward the employer if you do supply coverage, and it's called an unaffordability penalty. So in essence, what happens here is if you are supplying coverage to your employees, they're under 400% of poverty, because we give subsidies to individuals up to 400% of poverty in this legislation. If their cost of insurance that you're charging that employee exceeds 9.5% of their W-2 income. Originally, when we passed this health care bill, it was 9.5% of their household income. That's now been changed to W-2 income, so it helps the employer. It's easy for you to track that versus you have no idea what somebody's household income is.
Right. You don't know if the wife's working or
correct.
Or what's
so under the rules we just issued under the affordable penalty here in the last month, they changed it to W-2 income. And instead of family premium, it's now just based on single premium. So again, this penalty's improved if you look at it from an employer's mindset because it was 9.5% of family coverage based on household income, so a lot of people would qualify for it. Mm-hmm. Trimming it back to W-2 and single coverage makes it easier. But here's how it's going to work is if you've got somebody, let's say, that's going to be at 150% of poverty, which would be minimum wage, $7.85 an hour, if their insurance cost... you were charging an employee more than $130 a month for their health insurance coverage, which would be 9.5% of the W-2 income. That employee can waive off of your group coverage, go to the exchange, and we'll talk about exchanges here in a little bit, but go to the exchange, get assistance, and if they do that, then they're going to come back to you, the employer, and fine you $3,000 per employee that fits into that category.
So let me make sure I understand this correctly. Okay, I'm paying a person, and I have to go out and find cheap, low grade insurance for this person, so that he can. Basically, this is what it amounts to. You know.
Well, again, understanding the health care bill, we also defined a minimum essential benefit plan. So you're going to. When we look at 2014, when some of these provisions kick in, we have what we call precious metal plans. We have a bronze, a silver, a gold, and a platinum plan design. And the lowest coverage says it's got to be 60% of a 100% actuarial value plan. So there will be a minimum standard plan you're going to have to offer, of which you're going to have to be paying a certain amount of that premium. Otherwise, sure. You could see the second penalty.
So, as an employer, am I allowed to offer more than one plan then?
Yes, you are available to offer more than one plan. It's just you're going to have at least that minimum essential plan as your base plan.
Okay. Well, because see, over at Midwest Basement Systems, we've pretty much always just, well, as you well know, we've always just offered one plan and there it is.
Right.
Kind of take it or leave it kind of thing, you know. So then we'll have different grades later on, Seems like a bookkeeping headache to me, but okay.
Yeah, and what this will probably do is where we've got an employer today that may be paying, let's say, 50% of a single premium and 25% of their dependent cost. In 2014, I think we'll see a lot of employers make a decision that they probably won't contribute to the dependent cost and put more money toward the single premium so that they don't find themselves, you know, in the category where they're going to be penalized as second penalty for unaffordable coverage.
Hmm. Okay.
Because again, if you've got somebody making $10.47 an hour, you know, if you're charging them more than $172 a month for their share of premium, that would be considered to be unaffordable, and they'd be subject. You'd be subject to that penalty, potentially.
Okay. Well, I mean, I got to be honest with you. It doesn't sound real great to me, but I'm trying to be unbiased about this because I don't want people to vote a certain way because of something that I may say. You know, I want people to actually understand what it means to them. Again, to me, it just seems like anytime we talk about penalizing the job creators, that doesn't seem right. So we got to get to a break real quick. We'll be right back with more Around the House. Alrighty, welcome back, Iowa. You're listening to Around the House, and once again, I've got Jesse Patton here, and he is an expert in this healthcare thing that's going on in Washington, and he's the only guy that I've ever met that has read the entire law. So, and Jesse, let me ask you this. This essentially is a tax, isn't it? I mean, I personally didn't agree with the Supreme Court. I thought it would go a different direction, but they upheld this law because they called it a tax, and nobody was calling it a tax up until that point. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, again, inside of this 2,700 pages, there, you know, are a number of either what you want to call penalties or, in essence, what the Supreme Court said, the individual mandate is really a tax. As I work in Washington, a lot of things, I look at a lot of things as a tax that aren't considered a tax. You know, anytime they're taking money away from you, in my mind, right, that's a tax.
If I don't have a choice and right, they're taking it anyways, it's a tax.
But, in D.C., you define a tax a certain way because of who has the power to tax and who has the power to implement regulations, whether it's, a tax or appropriations. There were a lot of what they call appropriations in this health care bill, which means they're a one-time funding mechanism, and then Congress has to come back through and reappropriate money to it. That's where, depending on which side of the aisle you're on, you start talking about repeal and some of those things that, depending on who's elected, due to the fact a lot of it's funded under appropriation provisions, you may have a Congress makeup and a president that may not want to fund some of those components as we go forward. But, there's the tanning bed tax, which is 10% on tanning beds. There's the individual mandate, which is a tax.
There are a lot of new taxes here. I mean, and we touched on this last week about now you'll be paying tax when you sell your home.
Yeah, correct. If you're over 200, 250,000 of household income, there is a 3.8% unearned income tax in the in the provision.
Well, that's what they're starting out with. I mean, we all know that when they started out with we'll clear the heck back whenever they started taking money out of our checks for the tax payments, it was what, 2%? And now at the top rate is what, 36, something like that. So we're starting out with this 3.8% that we're paying on our household sales. What's it going to end up at? I guess my point here is, and this is, I'm an employer, but this matters to everybody. There's got to be a point where the government stops grabbing money from us. I heard the other day that 56% of every tax dollar we give to the government is spent on entitlements. Most people don't realize that 56% of our tax dollars are spent on entitlements. So we're going to give them more with this thing? So I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and when you look at the entitlement side, and I wasn't necessarily going down this path, but since you brought up the entitlements, and then depending on who you talk to, again, when you look at your Medicare tax and your Social Security tax, a lot of people say they're not true entitlements because I'm participating in those programs. But, the Medicare growth that we see, down into the future in like 2080, where we've now got 4 million baby boomers coming into Medicare every year, aging into Medicare. You know, it all of a sudden starts to consume, you know, 50% of the federal budget when we get down into, you know, 2080. It's just unsustainable.
That's huge.
And so, you know, no matter which president gets elected, you're going to see there's going to be quite a bit of work done on the Medicare program post-election. You know, there's already both sides of the aisle are looking at increasing the, you know, the Medicare eligibility age more towards 67 than 65. Now, both parties are pretty much going to leave the existing Medicare population alone if you were born after 1949 or 1955, depending on which side of the aisle you're looking at, is when they're proposing to start making those changes on, you know, some of our Medicare eligibility folks of increasing their age and some of those things. There's also an excise tax that really takes a place in this health care bill, and it's been deferred. It was originally the main component that really paid for this health care bill, but just due to pressures, you know, from the American population, we've deferred it out till 2018. It's a 40% excise tax on insurers. It'll actually be placed on the insurers. But again, then that, you know, will pass back through in your premiums. And what it says is that, you know, in 2018, if your value of your health plan is greater than $10,200 on a single or $27,500 on a family, there'll be a 40% excise tax, which again means it's a tax on insurers that they don't get to deduct. They got to pay and not deductible. Anything over that's going to be, you know, taxed at this 40%. Now, the value of the plans were really, you know, set in 2010, and then we deferred it to 2018, but we didn't change the value of the plan. So when you start to ratchet out the healthcare increasing premiums to 2018, you know, originally it was said that only the Cadillac plans, you know, the Goldman Sachs type plans would be subject to this excise tax. But when you look at where we've got the value of the plan and where premiums are increasing, again, what your point was, the majority of Americans are going to get hit with this excise tax in 2018 unless we change those numbers.
There is a trickle-down effect. I mean, the end user of whatever product is paying for this. You know, when you go to the auto parts store to buy spark plugs for your car, they're going to be more expensive. Okay, the end user ultimately is paying for this entire thing. So we can villainize whoever we want, whether it's, you know, the government, the job creators, the whatever. But the fact of the matter is, that's what's going to happen. The end user. All of us are going to pay for this. And what I had a question here that somebody wrote in, and we touched on the cost of this. And when we, what did you say last week, $2.3 trillion or something like that?
Well, again, originally, you know, when the when the bill was passed, it was just under, you know, the $1 trillion spending limit for 10 years. Now, you have to understand there's an SGR bill out there that has relationship to how we pay physicians, especially on Medicare. That legislation was peeled off and ran down a different path because it was at that point about $425 billion over 10 years. And so when you added that back into PACA, that extended this bill over $1 trillion, and the administration wanted to keep the price tag under $1 trillion. But there were other folks.
Keep the price tag under $1 trillion.
There was, you know, there was again a number of think tanks in Washington that looked at this, and based on the windows that we look at, this 10-year window, and you know, there were more estimates that were even higher at 2.3 or 2.5 trillion of actual dollars spent when we, you know, measured the bill out. So there's quite a variation between, you know, opinions out there as far as where the final price tag is going to come into play at the end of 10.
With everything in front of us, though, it just simply doesn't seem like we can afford this. I mean, it just doesn't seem like we can afford it, especially if there's a great deal of job loss because people need to get down below this 50-employee benchmark.
Correct. There's, you know, there's just a lot of uncertainty of how things are going to take place. As I said last week, even as we write rules for this, which changes things, just like with this affordability penalty that we've talked about. You know, the rules have lightened up a little bit, become a little bit easier on the employer than what they originally were in the health care bill.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, that discussion's not over because there are consumer groups and stuff that, you know, are lobbying the Congress saying that they want to go back to household income and they want to go back to family premium versus single. So we've seen the rules be amended even after we've gotten final rules, which makes it very difficult from your perspective as a business owner to really know how to plan because you just don't know what those costs and, you know, what the rules are going to be from day to day. And that provides uncertainty in the marketplace.
So it's going to take until 2014 for the arguments to stop and them to actually figure out what they want to do.
Well, at least now, remember, I told you, you know, this passed in 2010, goes to 2020. So, you know, we had a lot of stuff implement. 14's a lot of stuff, but there are continuous stuff up till 2020 that continues with this health care bill. Well, 2014, it's just not over in 2014. It continues.
Hmm. Well, I see a lot of guys just not being able to sustain this. I see a lot of... You know, a lot of households that are going to have a tough time here, too. You know, let's face it, if they're predicting $2.3 trillion over the next 10 years, the way the government works, we're probably looking at $5 or $6 trillion. You know, I mean, I don't want to throw huge numbers out there like that, but let's face it, how often is the government right when it comes to how much they're going to spend?
Not very often, unfortunately, in the past, if
right.
We look at the track record. They've missed the mark a few times.
Right. I just I have to wonder, you know, when you and your wife go out and spend money, you have to spend the money that you have. You don't get to spend. If there's $10,000 in your checking account, you can't go spend $15,000. It has to be $10,000 or under or somebody's coming after you. And that just doesn't seem to be the case in Washington. We got to get to another break real quick. We'll be right back with more Around the House so we can continue this discussion. So don't go nowhere. Alrighty, welcome back, Iowa. You're listening to Around the House, and ordinarily we're talking about home repair and improvement, and that's probably what everybody tunes in for. But last week and this week both, we were lucky enough to have Jesse Patton in here, and he really understands what's going on with the healthcare thing, and that's something that impacts everyone, and it impacts our house, so I guess I get to talk about it. And Jesse, before the break, we were talking about who gets to pay for this, and you know, I think it's going to bankrupt the country, even more so than it already is. I mean, we've got spending, which is wildly out of control in Washington, D.C., and now we're talking about another $2.3 trillion over the next 10 years. And it just, these numbers just seem crazy to me, absolutely crazy. But let's talk about the Independent Payment Advisory Board. And I don't know that most people even understand what this is. We touched about it last week, but can you explain that to us?
Sure. The Independent Payment Advisory Board is actually a provision in relationship to the Medicare side of the health care bill. The Independent Payment Advisory Board is a board constructed under the health care reform law to actually kind of oversee Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
It will be a 15-member panel that will be appointed by the president and then confirmed by the Senate. And they will then kind of take control of Medicare and make recommendations and guidance for Medicare on, you know, ways to improve it or change it or... As we talked last week, you know, the health care bill provisions provided that this board, once assembled over a 10-year period of time, would make some good decisions to Medicare and actually save Medicare about $16 billion over a 10-year period of time. In essence, today what happens is that Medicare has trustees and they issue a report on an annual basis, and if the Medicare Part A trust fund, which covers the hospital component of Medicare, has a solvency problem, then they issue a warning. The president has to take action to correct that, which you know, happened, I believe, three times in the Bush administration, a couple times in the Obama administration. But Congress currently doesn't have to act. And so in the Bush administration, he proposed legislation that said, you know, once the president takes action, if Congress doesn't, certain time frame, then, you know, the president's recommendation becomes law. Under PACA, what happens is that, you know, this board, once appointed, will make recommendations. The Congress and the president roughly, you know, have a time frame to take action. And if they don't, then the provisions that this board sets forth then becomes law.
So it's essentially, then you've got another branch of the government creating law.
Correct. You've got this, you know, Congress kind of forfeits the control of Medicare, which, again, there's a lot of discussion in Washington on both sides of the aisle that are not necessarily as enthused at this point in time as they were maybe in 2010, that they've given up some of their power over Medicare to this independent board.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's going to be a lot of discussion around this board. You know, on the Republican side of the aisle, this is where the death panel came out of the discussion, probably a little bit far-fetched, a little bit too far right.
What does that mean?
Well, it means what they, you know, what the right side of that aisle said was, you know, here's going to be this panel, and they're going to make a decision on, you know, care and those types of things that, you know, certain qualifiers may not be eligible for a hip replacement, for example, or certain qualifiers may not now be eligible for, you know, heart procedures based on...
Meaning lay there and die.
Well, yeah, based on your age and your outcome and, you know, some of those things that we may look at, this panel may say that, you know, certain quality of life and certain, you know, things and draw a line in the sand as far as who may or may not have those services. Now, again, that's just an assumption.
But it sounds like a pretty accurate assumption. And let's face it, some of these things sound pretty horrible, but this board would have this kind of power. Conceivably, they would have this kind of power.
Correct. And again, you know, the board, you know, has a staggered term. So the board really, you know, if you looked at it over the long haul, it'd be more of a Supreme Court environment because you would have, you know, some appointees serving through, you know, a president's term. And then, you know, new presidents would be appointing to this board and the initial board would be staggered, you know, in different years of term. So you'd have some stability there, but you'd have some, you know, new blood coming in, similar to the Supreme Court. When you lose a Supreme Court justice, you know, you may have a Democrat or Republican appointing in the new Supreme Court a justice. And this board would have that same characteristics. You would have, you know, multiple presidents confirming people to the board.
Well, and again, I want to remind about what I said about the tax. You know, when they first came up with the income tax, it was about 2%, and it exploded from there. Things tend to do that in Washington, D.C. And, you know, I still think we've got the best kind of government on the planet. The thing about it is, though, we're walking down a dangerous road with some of this stuff.
Yeah, and you know, when you look at Medicare, it's actually had kind of a reverse of that. In 1965, when Lyndon Johnson set up Medicare, Part A and B, Part A was mandatory, Part B being your medical insurance, he set up as a voluntary program because in those days, hospitals supported it and doctors didn't. But the cost sharing on the Medicare Part B, the medical insurance, was a 50-50 cost share, 50% by the citizens, 50% by the government. And Harry Truman was the first to sign up. It was $3 that the government paid, and he paid his $3. Over time, again, with the organized voters in the over 65 market, our government has decided to change that formula. It is now 75% paid by the government, 25% by the citizen. And our problem is now we've got these baby boomers coming into Medicare at a rate of 3.8 million a year. And we've lost our beneficiaries. We've got more beneficiaries growing than we've got taxpayers. And so now this 75-25 formula has really gotten us into some trouble. And so, again, one of the discussions in Washington post-election is, do they start to turn back that formula to maybe 65-35? Again, if we'd have left it at 50-50, we wouldn't have been in the problem we have today. But over their wisdom, they've changed it to 75-25.
Somebody needed votes, so, you know. Let's face it, that's what drives everything out there. Somebody needs votes. So what about now there's certain doctors that will not participate in Medicaid
Well, again, Medicaid is for folks under, you know, the poverty level. That's your Title 19. And Medicare is for folks that are 65 and over. Under 65 that have been on disability for Social Security disability for 2 years or have kidney failure or have Lou Gehrig's disease. There's some special provisions into Medicare for people under 65. And so there are roughly about 50 million beneficiaries in Medicare. And like I say, that's growing at about 4 million a year into the Medicare rolls each year with the baby boomers. Now, we did have a baby boom. It was either in 2007 or 2009. We had more babies born in this country than we ever had in the past. Our main issue now is that they won't come on payroll taxes until the baby boom generation that's hitting the Medicare and these entitlements start to come off of benefits. So we either need to get more people on payroll taxes, bring in more legal immigrants and get them on payroll taxes, or I kid around in my healthcare speeches that we may need to change the labor laws and get younger kids onto payroll taxes to help support the current system. But we do have a dilemma for a period of time with major funding issues based on our growth of our over 65 population. So when you look at our healthcare system, you know, our fastest growing population is over age 85. So the one thing we have done very well with our system is we're keeping people alive, you know, a lot longer. They're starting to talk in centers around D.C., you know, that with our healthcare improvements, 2030, 2035, we could start seeing life expectancies upwards of 125. So,
I'm not sure that I want that. I'm not sure I personally want that, but, you know.
So that puts a lot of pressure on our healthcare system, you know, as we continue to
keep. Yeah, a lot of stuff is going to have to change. I mean, you know, maybe retiring at 80 or something. And that sounds harsh too, but these decisions have to be made. I just don't think that there ought to be a board somewhere making decisions about whether or not, you know, my grandparents are taken care of.
Well, you know, our problem is the inactivity of the Congress not to act. And so they're trying to find solutions. And the board is one of those attempts to try to find a solution. But again, it falls back to, you know, it's really up to the elected congressmen and senators to manage that program. And they've needed to take action, and they've not been willing to for a number of years.
Okay. And they've actually, how many times has this thing been, they've tried to repeal it how many times now? I mean, this just doesn't seem like a real popular thing either. I don't get it.
It was done, as I said last week, we got to get about 80% of the people moving in the right direction. You're probably going to have 10% on both sides of the aisle that are going to be difficult to encompass. But, you know, since this is 1/6 of the economy, you get to get about 80% of the people moving in the same direction because, you know, it's going to take the provider, the payer, and the consumer to fix the healthcare issues that we've got. You got to have all three pegs of that stool working somewhat together, and we don't currently because of
the pricing. So having the government completely grab all of the power here is just not the answer.
No, because you still got to get cooperation from, you know, all the parties involved. Otherwise, you're not going to move the ball very far.
Hmm. Well, it always seems to come down right down party lines as far as how these votes come out. No matter what, you know, everything seems to come down right to party lines. And I don't think we're ever going to get there doing that. And every single president says, well, I'm going to reach across the aisle and try to work with the other side. But it never happens. So anyways, we got to get to another break real quick. We'll be right back with more Around the House. Alrighty, welcome back, Iowa. You're listening to Around the House. And again, I've got Jesse Patton here, who's been gracious enough to come in here and talk to us about the healthcare and what it means. And again, I apologize. We normally talk about home repair and improvement. So if you're listening, that's probably what you tuned in for. But again, you know, most people have no idea what this healthcare actually means to them. And I think it's important that they do. You know, we hear the talking points on the TV and the radio, but that's about it. So, Jesse, you mentioned at the break these cooperatives, and maybe you could elaborate on that so we can understand that.
Sure. In the healthcare legislation, there was a provision that was actually supplied by Senator Conrad from North Dakota. You know, his vision is that in the rural states like the Dakotas and Iowa, when you have a problem in a state, a lot of times you turn to cooperatives to help solve those problems. And we see cooperatives in rural electric cooperatives, and we see them in grain cooperatives. And so he kind of brought this to the table that one of our problems in a majority of our markets around the country is we don't have a lot of competition left in the health insurance industry. We've had a lot of consolidations of insurance carriers, and the markets are somewhat saturated. So his idea and the provision that was passed in PACA was the implementation of cooperatives in 2014, come January 1. Iowa is going to have a cooperative. It's going to be a dual state cooperative between Iowa and Nebraska. It's actually going to be called Cooperatunity, and it's actually then going to have a insurance product that they will bring to the street. It will bear risk just like a regular insurance company. And so it will provide another product on the street to compete against the United Healthcare, the Wellmarks, the Coventries, the Fortis, all the various carriers that we currently have in the marketplace as another option for you, the employer, to take a look at. Now, the cooperative under the law has to start marketing their product October 1st of 2013 for enrollment into that product as of January 1 of 2014. They get to operate for like a three-year period of time on a temporary board, and then at that point in time they have to phase over to a member-elected, member-run board for their cooperative. And in PACA, what happens is they provide funding for these cooperatives. I believe our cooperative here in Iowa, Nebraska, receives approximately about $128 million. $28 million of that is the startup cost to get their company up and going, and then they've got 5 years to get that paid back to the federal government. In our state, the insurance division requires $100 million of reserves. So of that $128 million, I believe $100 million goes into reserves, and then the government gives them 15 years to pay that funding back to the federal government. But again, they will then have an insurance product on the street that, again, will hopefully put a little bit of pressure on the other insurers and, create a little bit more marketing opportunity and maybe help, with the rates in that marketplace. And they will specifically really gear toward the individual market and the groups under 100, although they'll do business in any size market. But by law, they have to have a certain percentage of their enrollment in those markets.
So since they're using government money and really have very little skin in the game, they can come in and compete at a level that maybe a lot of insurance companies cannot compete at. Is that true?
Well, again, there's always two sides to the discussion. So one is that, they bring competition to the market. If I'm an existing insurance carrier, I may not be as excited because, as your viewpoint is that they're going to, receive tax dollars, in essence, to compete against the current private market that's there. At the end of the day, you hope that the competition it brings is going to, help regulate rates and keeps rates in check for the average.
But there's already how many insurance companies out there? What's one more? I mean, outside of the fact that, again, they don't have any of their own skin in the game, they didn't go get investors or, anything like that, like a normal, any startup company. And you brought up a great analogy at the break. It'd be like me having a basement waterproofing company, and the government deciding to install another waterproofing company to compete with me. And not only that, but let's give them $100 million to start up with,
Yeah, the issue when you look at our states, just due to consolidation of companies, we typically will see in the majority of states where you've got, anywhere from one to two carriers that have, 80% of the market share. So you've got pretty saturated markets. And what we're seeing is with this healthcare bill, more consolidation of the insurance companies versus, companies starting up. There was executive tax in this bill where if you've got companies with folks making over $500,000 a year, there's some additional taxes on how they report their income. So a lot of the the companies that were dabbling in the healthcare market, but were big PNC, property casualty companies, or big life companies, due to this executive tax in their in PACA, they pulled out of the market once healthcare reform passed. So again, we saw a lot of smaller carriers, especially in the individual market. We lost like 5 or 6 individual carriers in the marketplace once the healthcare bill passed. So we saw that saturation get even worse post-reform because of some of the provisions we're not even going to have time to talk about today.
Yeah, I just I understand exactly what you're saying. I just think that, so the government creates a situation where companies are falling off the shelf because they cannot survive, and then they install a company that is going to obviously agree with them because, if you give me $100 million, I'll agree with whatever you say. I guarantee you.
Yeah, I think the cooperatives will, and we're going to be very fortunate here. Our cooperatives CEO is going to be our former insurance commissioner of Iowa, Dave Lyons, who went from the insurance division to Iowa Department of Economic Development. Mm-hmm. I think we sit in a very good position with the leadership we're going to have in our cooperative.
Well, that's okay for right now when we are starting up. And this goes, again, back to my income tax scenario. Okay, when we started paying income tax, it was 2%. Things down the road seem to escalate. I just don't believe that the government can run something effectively long term.
Yeah, and now understand on the cooperative, it's going to be member run. So it's you're kind of voicing a concern. There's the cooperative probably doesn't hit that outside of your funding issues on that because they're going to be member run. Just in the last week or so, the administration issued some new rules on multi-state plans, which we had a public option in a healthcare bill before this passed that actually went away. But now what's going to happen is the administration is going to install multi-state plans and what we call exchanges that start up in 2014. These are going to be more of a nationwide plan, and there's going to be a lot of discussion around these because the concern will be, since they're really appointed by the federal government as a option inside of the exchange, they won't be possibly subject to state regulation. Mm-hmm. Which will give them a big competitive advantage over the other plans that have to abide by state regulation, which may be a little bit harsher than having a federal plan that operates in all 50 states in the District of Columbia. So the multi-state plans may have more advantages than what these cooperatives have because they will actually conform to state regulation.
Let me ask you this. And this is going to seem like an odd question. Let's say that we head on down the road here and we have this all this stuff, all this expensive stuff that, in my view, I don't see it really working out, but whatever. Let's say it doesn't work out. How do we get out of this later?
Well, that's the problem that we really have today is that we don't have any surplus funds to make a $128 million mistake.
Right.
So
or if a $2.3 trillion mistake over 10 years. That is a
Correct.
Whole bunch of money.
Correct.
And
that's our big issue today is if we go back a number of years, we might be able to go through one of these experimental programs and not be successful. Today, if we lose, millions or billions or trillions of dollars in some of these ventures and they don't work like we think they're going to work, we don't have a lot of surplus capital to go back
right.
and
then we got a real problem on our hands. It's like you brought up with the Medicare thing, where they changed the rules to where it's 75-25. I bet if they could go back and change that, they would,
Yeah, and again, it's really tough when you've got entitlement-type programs, especially in a down economic time like we are now, to start to go back and try to bring some of that money back when you're not giving people cost of living increases for Social Security and some of those things that have happened in the last mm-hmm. couple of years. It's harder now to try to go back and get $25 or $50 from every Medicare recipient in these economic
That's right.
times.
Well, we got about 30 seconds left, so I really want to thank you for coming on. And I want to give you another idea here. And, I'm not going to say which way I voted. If you haven't figured that out, I'm sorry. But the fact of the matter is that I truly believe Obama could have went down in history as the greatest president of all time if he would have paid attention to the economy instead of this ridiculous health care plan that I believe is going to really hurt our economy over time. If he would have got the economy up and running and not made it so hard to do business, which he has, he could have went down as the greatest president of all time. But he gave that up. So we will talk to you next week.